every issue that shows up in your Twitter feed or on the evening news has already been tackled somewhere in literature. I'm Vivi Ganeshanathan, also known as Sugi, the author of the novel Love Marriage.
And I'm Whitney Terrell, the author of the novel The Good Lieutenant.
Whit, have you ever written a mystery? I've never written a mystery.
Yeah, I mean, you know, The Good Lieutenant is a war novel, but it's also kind of a mystery in reverse. And my first novel, The Huntsman, was actually reviewed as a mystery by the great Marilyn Stasio in the New York Times.
Why was it reviewed as a mystery? That's so weird.
I know. The truth is, I was devastated when that happened at first. I think of myself as a literary writer. I thought of that as a literary novel. And it's about race and segregation and World War II. But, you know, her review was great, and she ended up making the book a New York Times notable book that year. So it turned out okay. And I realized, you know, that you can find literary novels all over the place that are inflected with and learned from mystery and crime novels, in good and bad ways.
And that's exactly what we're going to be talking about today, the omnipresent comfort narrative of mystery and crime fiction. Why do we love it so much? How does it influence the way Americans think about the world? And how do crime narratives shape the way we view Black Lives Matter and the shooting of young Black people by police? And for that, we're going to be joined by Matt Johnson, author of the novels Loving Day, Pim, Drop, and Hunting in Harlem, the nonfiction novella The Great Negro Plot, and the graphic novels Incognito and Dark Rain. Matt, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So look, it's so great to have you on. One of the things I do with all my friends is discuss what is the new crime show we're going to watch, and this happens in America. Why is this particular narrative form so enduring and addicting, do you think?
Which is that? The mystery crime genre story,
you know? I mean, we've been watching European ones, my wife and I. We watched a French one called Engrenage that was really good. We search for those things. She'll only watch police procedurals.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the mystery form is the fundamental, you know, structure of contemporary storytelling. And, the mystery comes out of the European Enlightenment and the idea that you can look at chaos and by applying your intellect, you can come to an understanding through reason as opposed to just saying God did it, right? But it has like a direct impact on the story. You know, the first story starts with Edgar Allan Poe's murders at the Rue Morgue, and it builds on that with Sherlock Holmes. But if you break down the mystery story where you start with the conflict and you try to solve that conflict and your initial attempt fails because the most obvious person never did it or the story is over, so you have to go through these paces of research. And by going through this research, you build other experiences, you get other information, and then you come to a different understanding that instead of it being A, it turns out it was B, right? And that's basically the structure for the contemporary novel, for most contemporary novels, even in the loosest sense. I mean, you have the most abstract novel. You're still compiling information as you go through the piece until the end, you know, there you reach some sort of larger understanding. So I think like that, like the way we think about story is already based on the mystery.
Right.
You know, if you look before the Enlightenment, like Beowulf does not fit that, you know, way of thinking, you know,
right. The
Iliad does not fit that way of thinking. So it's kind of like mainlining story, you know, for us. And then, you know, you add on to that, we live in a society where most people follow the rules and where, you know, many of us might consider a crime at different points. But even more than considering crime, I think we consider the consequences of a crime, like what would happen if I did this. So to watch people just break societal norms in a very direct way is, you know, incredibly fulfilling, you know. So, you know, whether it's like watching that, you know, documentary Wild Wild Country about the, you know, the ashram in Oregon, or whether it's, you know, Serial podcast or any of the other true crime things, I think we're fascinated by those moments because they in themselves are interesting, but they also end up saying so much about how we think about the world.
I never really thought of all stories as mysteries, but I suppose they are, especially because, I mean, I think of I gave a lecture on conflict to a bunch of undergrads, and I was giving them the kind of old Frank Conroy analogy, which is, oh, your reader is a person climbing a mountain with a bag, and they're collecting rocks of information. And if they get to the top and they're carrying rocks they don't need, they feel angry that they've been carrying sort of weight that they don't need.
Love that because I use that one all the time.
It helps them actually.
That's good. Yeah.
That image. And I think like, maybe that's what it's like reading the news now, that we're frantically, we're deluged with information and we don't know what we need. And we're sort of trying to fit these pieces together. And it's so hard. So I wonder, I mean, is it reasonable, Matt, do you think, to think about the ways that this formula, that mystery, helps us to think about the Mueller investigation, for example?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of the element to it, right? Like, definitely, like, you know, having it unfold and having new pieces of information come out, and the new pieces are constantly adding to clarity, to a vision. I mean, like, I was one of those people, like, I remember, I mean, we have a short memory as a culture, like, incredibly short, but I remember right before the election, there was a Slate article on pings from a server in Trump Tower that were hitting a bank in Russia, and people wondering about it. And I remember, like, listening to the Slate podcast and having, you know, people, you know, the hosts on the show talk about how that was just absurd and it was ridiculous, you know, but there was some connection with Russia, but it must be overblown. And then when people started to realize that the connection was realer, it started to have more clarity. But even when the first leaks of the dossier came out and kind of, like, surreally, you know, fit the most tin hat idea you had about the election, still there was, like, vague notions because there were so many threads. And, you know, was Donald Trump a plant all along, you know, ever since, you know, he first went to Russia? Were they planning this, which seemed absurd? But then, you know, later somewhat didn't, because then you look at, you know, him going to the beauty pageant and, like, what connections he made. And then they're saying, well, that's absurd because nobody knew he was going to run for president. And then you were like, wait a minute, do you forget he ran for president like every year? He just never got that far. So it's like, I think as these things come out, we had a general sense of what was going on before, but we still had kind of wild ideas. And so every time we get these bits of evidence, it adds more clarity to it, right? You get the meeting in the Seychelles, right? Which is, you know, straight out of a John le Clair novel. But you, like, all of a sudden have more clarity and it starts to become physical. So I think that becomes addictive. Like, now, like, I mean, it's like the worst podcast ever, because it just comes out, like, new episode randomly will come out in 6 weeks. And then there'll be 1 week with all this information that's too much to even, you know, really comprehend. And then you won't hear anything for another 2 months. Or not 2 months, really. It feels like 2 months, but it's probably about a week and a half. But, like, so you get these parts of it. And I think that fits into, you know, the mystery novel. But I think there's also this other sense that I think has, like, it used to drive me more, doesn't as much now, is this whole Trump situation is abhorrent. And so what you want for something is abhorrent is for it to be erased, you know?
Well, that's
like, not just rejected. But
erased. That's the structure of, like, a noir novel where, you know, the whole world is corrupt. Everything is rigged. It's not going to work, you know? And somebody like Philip Marlowe or Sam Spade or V.I. Warshawski or whoever, you know, comes in and solves it, you know? And in a way I love what you said about the Enlightenment earlier, right? I mean, it's an Enlightenment solution to a situation that's become non-Enlightenment or tribal or whatever, you know, a different...
Right.
Trump's not an Enlightenment politician.
Right. It's the opposite.
Yes,
right.
And we're... Yeah. I listened to a podcast recently, and I'll look this up. Hey, it's Whitney. I'm referring to a March 29th, 2018 edition of TrumpCast, where Jacob Weisberg talks to Timothy Snyder, the author of The Road to Unfreedom, Russia, Europe, America. Where a guy had written a book who's talking about what Trump practices is the politics of eternity. I thought was a really good term, in the sense that what he isn't looking about, he's not advocating for progress. He wants everything to be the same, you know?
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, and in that sense, it fits in, right? Like, we, you know, we've had this notion in America that the demographic tide is going to turn around 2040. And then when that turns, there's going to be this kind of inevitable shift in politics because of the change in the population, right? But, like, what that didn't take into consideration was that, like, people don't play fair. You know, that change has happened, but we have a massive gerrymandering problem. We have a massive voter intimidation problem. All of it is usually coaxed in the opposite Orwellian language. Like, we need integrity in our elections is a way of actually referring to we need to have voter intimidation to limit the number of people who can vote. So I think, like, this moment, regardless of Trump being this kind of extreme random a thing that happened by, 80,000 votes in the right territories. But this larger moment of this kind of white majority pushback, on the country, it makes sense within that. It's this change is not going to happen easily. And when the facts aren't on your side, people tend to resort to, other measures. They start justifying things that would never justify before.
What are you thinking of in terms of things that people are talking about that can't be justified or that they're justifying differently?
Well, I mean, like 80% of what Trump does, you can't really justify, based on our American ideals that we've been taught this whole time, you can't justify the fact that we do not have really representational elections at this point, right? We have states right now that are heavily gerrymandered to create more Republican representatives in government than not. And that's, they completely justify it, because, of things they basically make up, like voter intimidation. Or voter intimidation is coaxed under the fact that there's this massive amount of voter fraud that isn't happening. Right. Yeah. So they're justifying that. Just looking today at Trump's tweets, like he goes after Amazon because he wants to crush the Washington Post for negative criticism. He's going after really like anybody who gives him slight opposition this whole time. He's going after elected or not elected officials. He's going after the FBI, CIA. On the right, this would have been completely unimaginable, but they're doing it because it justifies their current position. So I think, if you think people are going to be fighting rationally, and fighting fairly, that's not happening. What you have instead is people justifying any action that allows them to maintain power and control. So, I think it's important for I think people on the left to understand that, because I think there was this concept and sort of complacency that by the rules, we're going to have more people voting this way and these things are going to change and that's inevitable. But that kind of misreads American history. The power, the justifications that we've had in the past about what is fair and what is, should be law was always open to interpretation. And it was specifically open to interpretation because it benefited the people in power. So now that it doesn't benefit the people in power, one by one, those rules are getting thrown out. And what it's revealing is what's been there the whole time.
And I think it's not an accident. I mean, one of the great things that noir can do when it's doing good things, and we're going to talk about some of the negative aspects of mystery and crime narratives later in the podcast, but is that great noir movies were made in the 30s when there was an awareness of a similar kind of income disparity and that powerful people were in control of politics and weren't responding to the democratic proposition. I mean, I don't think it's an accident. And so the detective is the person who restores order, restores enlightenment. But
right.
My concern with this, I mean, and Mueller is the perfect guy for it. I mean, he looks like Dick Tracy, for crying out loud. He looks like a private investigator to me anyway. And, but I think my concern is I think we're imagining that he's going to somehow fix this problem like a story would. And I don't think he's going to be able to do that. I don't think it's going to turn out that way. People are going to have to change this by, the democratic process, by being becoming politically active. And I worry that Mueller becomes he's the hero that we let fix the problem. Oh, he'll fix it. We'll watch him. I don't think it's going to turn out that way.
Right. We were talking before about police procedurals, and there's the one-off episode where you solve one case. And then there's the grand crime narrative of the global conspiracy. And I mean, what do we expect him to do, Robert Mueller, to fix all of American history, to fix the longstanding massive Republican project of decimating American public education, of making a less educated electorate, of making income inequality as wide as possible? I mean, Trump is not, he's not, he's the fruit of decades of work.
Yeah, and Trump is, as much as Trump is the problem, Trump is not the biggest problem. The biggest problem is he's being enabled by Republican Congress and Republican Senate, who wants to use him to get things they could never get done before. And he's also being enabled by 35% of the public in part because most of them are watching a propaganda station or getting all the news from a propaganda station and basically its affiliates. So they're in this kind of information bubble where facts, what they consider facts are things that make them feel good. So yeah, I mean, as far as Mueller as the detective, I mean, I think like he's definitely a detective in the traditional sense and he's going for the information. I'm actually have been surprised with how effective he has been in the sense of releasing information because, like, you know, he doesn't have to actually say what his findings are. I mean, he didn't have to release that information. I think what's making him release that information in part is to protect himself and protect the investigation so that it can continue, because if he doesn't release information, they're just going to pretend that none of this is real. So he's being forced into a situation that he might not even want to do. And I would think would not be doing it if you didn't have Trump and his allies out there saying this whole thing was fake and we need to shut it down. And so it'll be interesting to see in the end of it how much actual information is released, because, again, that's going to be voluntary on his part, and how much has to be pulled out by the Congress and the Senate. Whatever information he comes out with, because it's the president and because of the larger legal implications of it, the only way that we're going to be able to deal with Trump in office is through political means of impeachment. And even with impeachment, you're going to have to turn the Congress, the Senate, you're going to have to at least make it bluer to get it any further. And even then, I think you would be headed to a constitutional crisis, because you're dealing with somebody who has no shame, and that's one of his superpowers, right? So even if he's impeached by both the House and Senate and legally has to be removed from office, there's still a question of whether they can do that, besides actually having physical, you know, guns on the floor pulling them out. But I think
it's okay. I was just reminded of, do you guys remember? I mean, this is the fantasy. In part, I'm thinking about the way that the crime narrative with Mueller provides a kind of liberal fantasy, right? My fantasy, all right, is that Trump gets literally taken away in handcuffs. There, remember that meme that went around on Twitter that was like where they superimposed the administration figures onto gangsters' heads, right? And they were being arrested. I think that's
There's a bunch of them.
We kind of imagine that's going to happen. And I don't think it's good. It's not going to happen that way. You know, we have to let go of that illusion.
All this is so nuts that, like, none of it seems, there's no outcome that is based on our existing notion of reality. There's just none. You know what I mean? Like, that's the thing. And so, like, we're in a position that if it wasn't horrific would be exciting in a novel, because anything that happens after this point is crazy. The exciting thing about the mystery novel is there is a sort of set movement towards, you know, order beating chaos.
Right.
Order that's imposed by the human mind beats chaos, pushes chaos back. And even in the nihilistic stories where, you know, you find out who did it, but who did it is so powerful that nothing really changes, there's still an acknowledgement there that the truth has been revealed, even if the truth is that nothing changes. So the chances are we're moving more towards that model. But I mean, honestly, like, the vast majority of books that are bought in the world are mystery novels.
Yes.
The second biggest group of books that are bought are thrillers. And thrillers are just mystery novels where you know who did it. You just want to see if they get away with it. And so what we have is not mystery. We have a thriller. The thriller is that in plain sight, based on what we already know, we have somebody who is clearly guilty of one of conspiring with a foreign power that's hostile to this country to basically overtake the country. I mean, that's basically what we're talking about, even though it sounds like insane language. And also with the corruption, just financial corruption with the Trump hotels, with Mar-a-Lago, like with all these places, we already know the crimes. Like, that's not a question. What the question we have now is, does he get caught? Right. So, I mean, and so in that sense, it is a thriller. Like, I, in the sense of a thriller, even if he gets caught in this case, because the way our society is set up and because there's a huge portion of our population who just doesn't care, it'll be interesting to see what comes out.
I'm now thinking of one of my favorite movies from when I was younger. I really liked The Untouchables and attempting to watch Elliot yeah. Ness catch Al Capone. And in the end, they get him, of course, on taxes. Right. They don't get him for any of the major crimes he did, but they still succeed in putting him away. That distinction between thriller and mystery is super useful. I think also in your comments about Fox News, I can't help but think I keep fantasizing specifically about this one scene in Superman 2. And people who know me know that I love the original Superman movies, but I don't think I've talked about them on this podcast yet. But I think about them all the time in connection to politics. There's these scenes where the supervillains from Krypton have taken over Earth and the United States, and they go into the White House and they make everyone kneel and they're looking for the president. And there's a broadcast kind of going out to everyone. Everyone is seeing these supervillains on the air. And then the president sort of stands up and reveals himself, even though the rest of his staff is trying to protect him. And he breaks the broadcast by not following the rules. And he starts sort of yelling, "Superman, where are you?" And mm-hmm. And Superman, of course, somewhere else sees this and sort of comes to the rescue. And I keep sort of waiting for some version of that scene to play out.
Yeah.
Of course, it's never Superman going coming. To. And that is Fox News. Fox News is run by General Zod.
Right. And it's more like Superman 3, but this time Richard Pryor never gets caught stealing, right? Everybody knows he's stealing and he gets off with it. Yeah. I mean, there's going to be no Superman moment. It's going to be an Untouchables moment. If Trump goes down, it amazingly probably won't be for his largest crimes. It'll be for something dumb like the Stormy Daniels incident or something, you know, associated along those lines. And the reason is because those types of crimes are not open for interpretation as much as questions about collusion and how they influence things, right? The crime of giving somebody $130,000 or whatever amount she got to shut up, a week before the election is very easy to prosecute because it's cut and dry, right? So there's no like sort of partisan interpretation that can really free you from that. So I imagine that's going to happen. I mean, honestly, this is how I'm thinking things go down. I think what goes down is we find out all these horrific things that are going to be connected to collusion with the Kremlin, you know, and I think it's important to say the Kremlin as opposed to Russia because, you know, there's lots of wonderful Russians who have to deal with a horrible government just like we have to deal with a horrible government, specifically the Kremlin and Putin. We're going to find out about that information. There's going to be probably Congress is going to switch. He's going to get impeachment, but he won't leave office. What might happen is after he does leave office, after 4 years, there's so many crimes around, you know, between Jared Kushner, his dealings and, you know, Don Jr. and all the things that are there, that we're probably going to see prosecutions go on after the 2020 election. And if he ever actually ends up serving time, I could actually, I mean, I really could see it. I mean, at this point, it's going to be difficult to avoid if he's not in power. You know, particularly if you get a Democratic House and Senate and a Democratic president, I think they're not going to, in the past, they've let it go. They want to move on. But I think this has reached the level of, you know, we can't move on as a society unless we address these basic rules. And I think there's going to be prosecutions after that point.
Well, that's why the Watergate narrative is so important in the American imagination, because it was a place where somebody attempted to move away from rule of law and rule of law eventually stopped it, you know. But there wasn't a guarantee that that would work out that way. There were many, many moments in that story where it could have gone differently. And that's what's scary about this one. We don't know that it's going to have a happy ending. You know?
Yeah, Nixon had shame. Nixon wasn't impeached. He left the office because it looked like he was going to get impeached. Trump would be happy to be impeached by both the House and Senate and stay in office to wait out his time. And if he does that, by the time that goes through, so you imagine there's an election switch, maybe he's impeached this time next year, it's 2019, right? If it's 2019 and he's been impeached by the House and Senate and won't leave, do you send in the National Guard to remove him? Or do you just wait till 2020 and vote him out? And chances are you wait till 2020 and vote him out, because the impact on the culture will probably be too dramatic to actually remove him the way, you know, people imagine. So, I mean, I just cannot see any point where he acknowledges what he's done. So I think that's kind of where we're headed.
I want to just point out, and then we should probably move on to the next topic, and maybe this will lead us there, is that, and as we're talking about how dominant the narrative of crime fiction and mystery fiction is in the way that we think about what's happening politically today, Trump himself is a kind, I think, thinks of himself as a form of there's a form of detective that is the law-breaking detective, the detective who will come and break the law so that we don't have to. And those are usually the ones that are more troubling as detective characters. Somebody like Mike Hammer, somebody who's somewhat of a sadist, somebody who maybe is a racist, somebody who will, you know, or Dirty Harry, for instance, right? And Trump sees himself in that mold also. I just want to say that the right is using this form of thinking as well, just a slightly different one than the left does.
Definitely, 100%. I mean, that's his cover. His cover is that, you know, he's like, you know, I can't remember the main character from The Shield. Like, he's corrupt, but he's corrupt trying to fight for you. He'll do anything for you, even if it breaks the law, right?
Right.
So, I mean, and I think that's his cover. Now, of course, he's also incredibly corrupt financially and in other ways that doesn't serve anyone else but himself. There was an article today in the New York Magazine from Jonathan Chait talking about the fact that he's actually vulnerable on the idea of corruption financially, that he's just serving himself, because that goes counter narrative to the idea that he's a wealthy guy who put it all aside to fight for you. No, he's actually fighting for himself, and we can show the actual financial reports that prove that his Trump organization is actually the beneficiary of all his work, as opposed to, you know, everyday working people. Of course, like, the idea that everyday working people are the ones that voted him in is part of the myth of Trump. The majority of whites who voted for him were middle class and upper.
And I think, you know, earlier you mentioned Stormy Daniels, and I mean, I keep thinking of her as Breathless Mahoney from Dick Tracy, but maybe she's actually the person who would put it all aside to fight for us. I mean, she's also obviously fighting for herself, but she sort of fits into this Dame with a Heart of Gold narrative in some sense. And there's this whole cast of characters around Trump who fit into these certain types. And I mean, I think my sort of fantasy narrative allegiance is vacillating between her and James Comey and Mueller. You know, could one of them save us? And I think I gotta let it go, but she's certainly captivating in that way.
Yeah, how would she save everybody?
I mean, I think just by sort of, I guess I imagine some sort of trial where she's giving dramatic testimony about the wrongs that she's done. And then there's the judiciary system actually works. And, you know, what you said about Trump going to jail in 2023, I mean, that sounds like such a lovely dream. Right. You know, I think the way as a mystery reader of the Trump administration, I think some of the pieces that I'm trying to put together are, how does Stormy Daniels fit into the Mueller investigation? How does that connect to Russia if it does? I mean, how can those different dots be aligned? And I long to see it. I'm trying, working really hard to put that plot together. And I think I'm not sure it's there.
It's fascinating. Like, you know, again, like, his superpower is shame, right? And then you're dealing with somebody who works in the adult industry, who's had to deal with shame, you know, directly for most of her career, right? So, like, she's in many ways the perfect nemesis for him, you know, to see them kind of them trying to crush her and put her down, and how kind of gracefully and, you know, it seems like with ease she pushes back on it. I mean, I like, most likely all these things will end with these side characters that he has. Like, you know, they remind me of like Dick Tracy's, you know, band of villains, you know. They're all kind of grotesque in their own ways. They are all screwed, you know, like everyone around him is going to have legal jeopardy for years. My fantasy along that line is that these kind of, you know, these minor subplots that happen, that one of them is, you know, is the Al Capone tax moment, the one that crushes through.
I mean, the flip side to our fantasizing about detective, you know, the one man who can save it all, the lone gumshoe striking through, is that I think American fantasies about the ways that cops are in their communities have really affected also not only our reading of things like the Mueller investigation, but also the way that people are reading coverage of police shootings of Black Americans. And I follow you on Twitter and have especially been appreciating your tweets in response to that news. And I wonder if we can talk a little bit about how American imagination around cops plays into not only the Mueller investigation, but also American fantasies of the police always being in the right. Because when Whit and I were talking about this episode and thinking about the way that the crime genre and especially noir affect how we read this kind of news, it was impossible not to think of Incognito, which is, of course, a graphic mystery and says that on a cover.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say this first, like my uncle's a cop. My family, my father's side of the family is a military family. Many of them served in the 82nd Airborne, started with my grandfather who jumped out of a plane in North Africa when they first started. So like I come from one of those families, and, my family's just assholes like everybody else. I mean, like, it's just people with problems, you know, just like everybody else. But we live in a society that its primary goal is the maintenance of order, above all things. And, you know, we deal with the repercussions of that, but that is our primary goal. So if there's a protest that fights against, you know, Black people, mostly men, but also women, being disproportionately killed by police using gun violence, that agitates the status quo, right? And that is a challenge to the norm. And so in reaction to it, there's, you know, the condemnations and this larger discomfort, even by the mainstream press. I'm from Philly. When the Eagles won the Super Bowl, we had, you know, people in the streets, largely white, but just people in the streets ripping down poles and flipping cars and all that, doing the same kind of physical violence that's often used as the primary criticism of social protests. And there was no larger kind of rebuttal to that. There was nobody had a problem with it because it doesn't challenge the social norms, right? It doesn't challenge those norms. And I think along with the police officers, there's a fetishization of the police and military families because they uphold the social norms. And because they uphold the social norms, you know, they are given leeway that no one else in society would have as far as criticism goes, right? So, like, we can just start with, like, that point with dealing with the police. But if you create a situation that's also backed up by the law that says that people are above criticism, you know, and really above reprimand, and you say police officers are allowed to kill people if they feel threatened, and that they're allowed to shoot first and ask questions later, you know, because they are the special class of people, then you end up with the disaster that we have right now. Now, there's a lot of noirs where the police are corrupt, you know, and there's a lot of noirs where the police are incompetent. You know, mystery novels tend to have police are incompetent because it justifies the fact that, you know, like a housewife from, you know, the suburban Virginia is solving crimes. Right. Why is she solving crimes? Because, you know, the police are incompetent. What we don't have as a tradition is mystery novels where the corruption is not just localized, but endemic in the system. You know, there might be a bad cop, there might be a bad precinct, but there's not a challenge oftentimes. I mean, there's individual books that do that, but it's not part of the mainstream canon that the structure of our police force is just custom made for abuses.
And it's also important to think about, I mean, that's, you know, how many police procedural narratives exist and how they're on television all the time, you know. CSI's on all the time. I don't even, you know, that show was on for years. Law and Order, all these shows that have been on for decades now, right? Enforcing sort of the same basic precepts of how to think about law enforcement. And they all, you know, it's always using like the bad apple approach toward police corruption, right? And never really addressing this other issue. I just think people forget how much our narrative is affected by that. How it's like a form of constant, permanent pro-law enforcement propaganda, that comes out of Hollywood and out of our books, you know?
Totally. And like Law and Order would be more accurate if 20% of the episodes nailed somebody and basically set them up for a crime they didn't commit. I mean, right. That would make much more sense. You know, I mean, just the effectiveness, even if it was 15% of the episodes, like that would be a lot more effective, you know, to show these crimes happen. They have somebody, the person didn't do it, and they end up going to jail. And like they're conscious that they don't have a strong enough case, but they think, oh, well, they probably did something and they go to jail. Like that would be more effective.
Where you have police who just don't believe things that are true. I mean, today I just was listening on the radio. The sheriff in Sacramento was saying, like, after the protester had been hit by one of the sheriff's department cars, saying, like, these were paid protesters. There's no right. evidence for that. Like, the mindset that person would have to say that these protesters in Sacramento were paid is a kind of thing that is a kind of propaganda issue, similar to what we were talking about earlier with Fox News, that I don't find police narratives addressing very often right now.
Right. Yeah. And that's not similar to Fox News. That is Fox News.
Right.
I mean, that's where it's created. They create a narrative that allows people to write off all these things as not being real. And, you know, all the facts that they don't want to deal with, they either give just cursory glance to them or they create counter narratives. Those counter narratives go on TV. They get echoed on radio shows. And these people, you know, there's many people and many of them are police officers who that's the only news they get. And they're also trained to believe that all other news is actually propaganda, but what they have is the actual truth, right? So, you know, a direct result of that is that kind of belief, right? I mean, we had similar problems before we had cable news, you know? So, like, it's not just Fox. It's a tendency for people to want to believe the worst about people they don't agree with, and also to constantly paint themselves as the good guys. I mean, that's just inherent act. But right now, you spoke about Incognito, which is, you know, is about lynching, you know, in the 1920s. When I wrote that book, part of the inspiration for that book was that my great-grandfather escaped a lynching in South Carolina and moved to Chicago, changed his name to Jones so nobody would find him. It was the most common name in the phone book. And for years, he sat in a chair staring at the door of his apartment with a shotgun waiting for them to come to him. And actually, like just like yesterday, I had a huge breakthrough in the research. A cousin of mine figured out what the crime was, what was going on, what he ran from. And now I'm looking at all these articles from this story where there was a shooting and it was a fight over a mule. And my great-grandfather was accused of shooting the landowner who came to take the mule from the sharecropping farm. And they were going to lynch him. So, you know, I don't know the story because when I look back, all the articles are filtered through the white imagination, and I don't know what's true and what isn't. I don't know what people are making up and isn't. I don't trust the legal system and how it looks at blacks in 1905 in South Carolina. So I have to decipher even what's going on. They're openly talking about lynching him. If there's a trial, if they catch him and there's a trial, if there's a not guilty verdict, they're going to lynch him. And so, like, when I'm listening to these stories and hearing them, you know, this moment clicked where I'm like, if they had caught him, I would not be here, right? I would not be here. My mother would not be here. My cousins, my kids, none of us would exist, right? And then to build on that, you know, when you look at almost, I think it's close to 4,500 lynchings between Reconstruction up until World War II, 5,000 people, think of all the people that should be here on this earth that aren't because of these acts, right? I mean, so these acts don't just have an immediate impact on a community. They have an incalculable impact going forward on a community. And so, like, these narratives that we have to reinforce it justify not just kind of a murder, but also these like, inherently political acts that can, if you look over centuries, can have this incredible impact on communities. So, you know, part of what I do is try to change the narrative.
That's an amazing story. Thank you so much for sharing it with us. And I think, you know, we asked you to be on the show, and then I was revisiting Incognito and was looking on the website and was realizing that it's the 10th anniversary edition is out. And I think of fiction, I mean, you're describing it in some ways, and I think of it this way too, as a form of time travel. And we're talking about noir here, but the idea of noir as a form of time travel, both in style and then also in Incognito, Zane Pinchback goes undercover to investigate lynchings, and he ends up checking out a charge against his brother. And now for this 10th anniversary edition, you added some new content. You also wrote two new mini prequels, both also starring Zane Pinchback. And I'm wondering what it was like for you to revisit that world in the current political conversation, to work on that new edition of the first book, and to write new stories for Zane, especially in light of the conversations that we're having about, I mean, police bias now, and what you're saying about in that long, long wake of killings, the long, long wake of a murder, one murder, and then the thousands that you refer to.
Yeah, I mean, we reissued the original with like enhanced art and other stuff, and we have a new series. Like, I think issue 3 might be on the stands right now. We're going to do 5 issues, and then also be another graphic novel, a prequel set in the Harlem Renaissance. The thing about going into the past is trying not to be depressed, because the trick is, you know, part of the way that the system maintains itself is by constantly saying it's better than it was, it's better than it was, it's better than it was, right? So it gives you this feeling that history is inevitable and it moves forward. And basically, if you just sit in your canoe, you'll flow with the current, right? So, but when you go back, you find something a lot more complicated. And, you know, in some ways, things definitely have improved. But some of the core underlying issues of, you know, Black people in America, in terms of you know, the police, in terms of justice in the courts, has really not changed at all. There's been, you know, many cases, modern cases, that match up almost identically with cases going back to, you know, the Civil War. So that's the part that's hard to not get frustrated on. You know, when I'm looking at this case that they brought against my great-grandfather, I can see all the patterns of a contemporary case against a Black man in our society who does not have power, is not particularly wealthy. Those are all there. You know, the filings of police that are incredibly suspect, that don't even make sense, you look back, they're there. The kind of railroading is there. The assumption of evil, basically, on the part of the African-American subjects, which kind of enables them to say, well, even if he didn't do this, he probably did something, right? Those are all there. And on the other side, there still is a judicial system that says, okay, we have checks and balances as well, which is both, you know, like kind of revelatory for me to see that even then, you know, the case that I'm looking at went to the Supreme Court because basically a Black neighbor showed up to see what was going on. And because they couldn't find whoever did do the shooting, they arrested the neighbor with no evidence, even though they had an alibi of being 3 miles away at home. They didn't care. And he ended up undergoing 3 trials until he was eventually freed 4 years later. So there's like all these things that are similar. So on one hand, like when I look at the past, and really when you're writing in the past, you're kind of reliving the past. I think you have to keep your eyes open as to how, you know, that some things have gotten better, but how many things have not gotten better at all. And then on the other side of it, you know, I think you also have to look at those times as a way of understanding the present. Sometimes it's hard to look at the present just because we don't have all the information involved in different cases. But when you look at the past and you see these false convictions and these false testimonies and, you know, all these things that we see now over 5 years, you can go look and see the entire pattern play out. And so, like, and other thing, too, I think it's easier if you feel challenged by looking at racial injustice in the country. If you're white and you feel challenged directly when people talk about the oppression of African Americans, because you think in some ways it implicates you, you think in some ways that it delegitimizes your own struggle, you know, like the white privilege discussion, you know, it is threatening because it says to somebody, yeah, you worked hard and all that, but you had it easy compared to these people. That's threatening to people's self-image. But if you look to the past, I think it's a first step to acknowledging those underlying issues, that these things happen. The second step is acknowledging that these things haven't changed as much as you like to believe.
Well, all of the things and that so you're Zane- talking about are present in the Stephen Clark shooting, you know, a presumption of evil, like you said, like, well, he's definitely got a gun in his hand, not a cell phone, you know.
Yeah.
All that stuff is happening in that case, you know.
I promise you, your grandchildren will look back and will not believe how racist a society it was today. And some of the stuff will still be happening, but it'll be easy for them to diagnose it in the past than it is in the present.
And one of the most interesting things about Zane Pinchback, and I don't think I said this earlier, Zane Pinchback Incognito comes from this notion of passing, and he's a very light-skinned Black man who uses that identity to move in and out of white spaces, to reveal them, to be plotting against Black people in various ways. And the idea of him as a racial detective is so compelling to me. So I just want to give our listeners a taste for how this book is, and Matt is out of town, so I'm actually going to read from it. And these are some scenes with terrific, terrific art, so I really encourage everyone to pick up a copy. All right. Ladies and gentlemen, the famous Incognito himself, death-defying undercover octoroon of the modern age. My buddy Zane, the high yeller super Negro, able to pass for a Nordic in the blink of an eye. But I'm not famous, that's sort of the point. Of course you're famous, says his female companion. Everyone reads your investigations into the lynching problem. All of Harlem knows Incognito. Exactly. Everyone knows who Incognito is, Zane says. But Zane Pinchback is a nobody. It is the age of the Black writer, and Zane Pinchback has done nothing, it appears. That's absurd. You're published in every Black paper and pamphlet in the North. If it wasn't for your investigative work, many of these lynchings would never be revealed. Zane says, but I want to be revealed too. There is a movement happening right here in Harlem, a renaissance. I'm a writer. How could I not want to be a part of that? George Schuyler, the columnist from The Messenger, even he's got a novel coming out. Answer simple. Keep up the investigative stuff you're known for, his friend advises, but publish under your own name and picture. We could have a big coming out party at Small's Paradise. Ladies free before 10. Cash bar, of course. Carl, that is a thoroughly bad idea. Well, you could do an open bar if the Herald will pay for it. Zane says, if I publish under my name and picture, I can never do undercover again. The price of fame, Chappie. The price of fame. So Zane goes on to meet with his editor and intends to quit. And there is a character in here who reminds me very much of kind of Jonah Jameson or Perry White. And there's a great four-panel page that sort of shows him making the decision to stick around. And if this is another attempt to keep me, Zane says, look at the name, his editor says. Look at the dates. I'm not trying to shit you, Zane. It just came in last night. Pause. God damn it. God damn it. And then his editor sort of challenges him to stay around and make things right. And he says, all right, fine. I'm on this last story, but this changes nothing. When I come back, I better have an office, and it better say managing editor on the door. Make it back and make it back safe, and I'll give you that and a column with your picture on the front, but not a raise. So here, kind of using all of the tropes of the journalist as with other investigations going on, some of which their editor knows about and some of which they don't, fantasies of another more productive life, exploring their creativity. And at the same time, this really righteous cause, which Matt, as you were saying earlier, kind of exceeds the standard detective narrative in that he's looking at an individual injustice, but also one that indicts the broader system. And it's so interesting to watch these tropes played with in this way. The idea of Zane Pinchback, and also like what a great name, right? Zane Pinchback is someone with his superpower being maybe his ability to pass, and also his journalistic skills, his ability to see the system for what it is.
Yeah. First of all, it sounds a lot better when you read it than when I do.
So
thank you for that. I think it's funny because the journalism question is a huge one now too, right? And the Washington Post is doing great work, and New York Times occasionally does good work, less so. But I think we do also have this fantasy that's based on the pillars of society that the journalism will serve as a corrective for the larger bureaucracies and larger society. I think that also can be another version of the Robert Mueller, savior complex, that journalism will save us. But when I originally wrote it, it was inspired by the black press of the, the early 20th century and also late 19th century, and specifically with Walter White, who was an African-American who looked white. Walter White existed before Breaking Bad, and he was one of the former heads of the NAACP. And I wanted to kind of let that, be an in, not just to the story, but also as a tribute to those black presses. Because at the time, lynchings would happen, and, sometimes they weren't even covered. And when they were covered, it would be vague responses that, the community took the matter into their own hands. And so Walter White and other black press representatives would find information about lynching and publish those in places like the Chicago Defender, the Amsterdam News, places in the North, those stories were just not being told. So it was really kind of exciting. I mean, I worked briefly for the Amsterdam News, just as a freelance writer when I was in school and at graduate school. And it was a way to kind of pay homage to that there's always been journalists out there, who are trying to fight the prevalent narrative with facts.
I want to just give a shout out to Kansas City's longstanding African-American newspaper, The Call, which was an incredibly important force, particularly in the 60s during the civil rights movement. And we had riots here in 1968, which we recently have been talking about a lot. And The Call was the paper that wrote all of those important stories, the stories that the Star wouldn't write at the time. Right. And so, yes, I love that part of your narrative. That was really important.
Yeah, and Kansas City is an excellent example. Here's a place that has a history, a really kind of troubled racial history, of riots and massacres going back, back through the century.
No doubt.
And then, to have somebody be able to actually, say it from their own perspective, as opposed to kind of filtered through like a mainstream white perspective, was priceless. And, I think the black press doesn't exist sort of in the same way, but the comparison today would be, alternative presses who and smaller magazines and even some of the bigger ones that are allowed to do deep dives into information that, the main ways we get media through TV just simply can't or sometimes isn't interested in doing. So it's one of the reasons that like Trump's attack on Amazon and the Washington Post is an anathema to what America is supposed to stand for, and that these presses are they're not part of the government, but that's the point. They're outside of the government and they're supposed to be telling us what's really going on.
Matt, thank you so much for joining us. It's been really great having you on. Listeners, check out the new edition of Incognito and its brand new prequels just out. And we will link to those on our Facebook and Twitter pages and also send you to Matt's website where you can read more about his work. Matt, thanks so much.
Thank you. It was fun to talk to you.
Thanks a lot, Matt. And that's it for the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast. If you're interested in crime narratives like we are, we have a great recommendation for you. Our parent site, LitHub, has launched an awesome new webpage. It's called Crime Reads, and you can find it at crimereads.com. Right there, along with a mountain of terrific crime and mystery fiction content, they have a guide to the essential crime TV of April 2018. Please go and visit. Our theme music is composed by Travis Workman. You can subscribe to us by typing fiction/non/fiction into the search bar of your favorite podcast app. You can also listen, find previous episodes, and read excerpts from our interviews at the Literary Hub website, lithub.com. Where the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast page is listed under the News tab. We'll post a link to the books we referenced this week on our Lit Hub show page, on Facebook at FNF Pod, and on Twitter at FNF Talk.